The Daniel Hajj message, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, warns of enemies' attempts to weaken unity and spirituality among Muslims. U.S. announces new military aid package for Ukraine, which includes weapons Pentagon officials say will help Kiev strike Russian targets at a longer range. And Japanese police say the man suspected of killing former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe held a grudge against an organization he believed Abe was part of. Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to World News. Now, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the annual event of the Hajj pilgrimage, calling for unity among Muslims. Now, the leader said enemies have long strived to sow division and undermine the spirituality of Muslims. Ayatollah Khamenei, however, said the Islamic world is today ready to foil such plots. He said that this is due to resistance and the fact that Muslims are more aware of the grand value of their religion. Ayatollah Khamenei said there is a large number of young people in Islamic countries who are energetic and highly motivated, and he termed those youth valuable assets in shaping the future of Islam. Also in his message, the leader said the Islamic Republic is a good example of how Islamic sovereignty, together with the people's vote, can form the principles of governance in a country. The leader hailed what he called the stability, independence, progress and honor of the Islamic Republic as a meaningful phenomenon that can attract the thoughts of every conscious Muslim. Political commentator Sayyid Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier to give us his thoughts. He says Hajj is a symbol of equality and a stance against oppression.
The problems that Muslims face and the problems by extension that West faces, and what's going on in West Asia at the moment in terms of the oppression of Yemen, the oppression of the likes of the Palestinians, the oppression of Afghanistan, you know, all across that region, it's littered with the oppression of Zionists and the imperialists. For the Saudis to reject that obviously is a political move, because they're hand in glove with that very oppression. They're the ones fighting in Yemen. They're the ones funding a lot of the terrorism around that region. They're the ones who give the Americans and the Zionists a foothold in the region. And they're the ones who spread religious ideologies which sectarianize and divide. Well, the Hajj goes against the vein of all of that. And, you know, the enemies, of course, who try to weaken Islam's spirituality, who are weakening even Westerners themselves in terms of their morality and spirituality, they have this neoliberal material ideology, which again, the Hajj rejects. You can see the two pieces of cloth which Muslims wear at the Hajj, the simplicity of it, the beauty of it, and the circumambulation and the Kaaba, all represent this kind of lack of materialism and this kind of alternative worldview. And I think that's what scares, certainly, the Zionist Western Empire, which is the primary problem creator across the globe today. And that's what actually empowers the resistance axis.
And we spoke to a political commentator, Mohsen Saleh, about the importance of the Hajj pilgrimage and how it helps Muslims confront Western countries' plans aimed at Islamic nations.
Muslims can unite in order to bring to themselves all kinds of peace and tranquility and deal with each other like what is happening there in Al-Hajj. So uniting people as on the micro level in Al-Hajj may mirror itself, may reflect itself in other issues. So that can really defend and confront the West from its satanic plans against Muslims. The usurpation of Palestine, the intervention of the United States in all over the Islamic world, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Palestine, in Iraq, and trying to attack the Islamic Republic, which is representing all Muslims, and especially the leader is really his eye and his mind and his feelings and his emotions are directed towards uniting Muslims.
Muslims from around the world are performing the annual Hajj in Saudi Arabia as the pilgrimage reaches its apex. The worshippers are staying the night at a holy site after spending the day praying on Mount Arafat. The pilgrims will then get ready for the symbolic stoning of the devil ceremony in the nearby city of Mina on Saturday. The day marks Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, which is a major occasion on the Islamic calendar. This year's Hajj pilgrimage is the biggest since the coronavirus began, or the pandemic at least. Now, 1 million Muslims, including 850,000 from outside of Saudi Arabia, are taking part in this year's pilgrimage. Hajj is one of the largest annual religious gatherings on the planet.
Over a million Muslims converged on the Arafat Desert in Saudi Arabia as the biggest Hajj pilgrimage since the beginning of the pandemic is nearing its climax. Arafat signifies the high point of the Hajj pilgrimage, where the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, delivered his final sermon calling for equality and unity among Muslims.
Actually, Hajj season is of supreme importance because they have been all brought together for the unity of the Islamic Ummah. God could tell everybody to stay in their own home country and do the prayer, say the prayer, and do Hajj rituals. But it wasn't do so because God wanted to bring all the Islamic Ummah together so that they could get to know each other and communicate with one another. This is the importance of the unity of Hajj.
The pilgrims set out for Arafat before dawn and spent the night in deep contemplation. They also gathered on the Mountain of Mercy, offering prayers of repentance. Muslims believe prayers in Arafat are the best opportunity for salvation and spiritual renewal.
Arafat is a very sacred and holy place because all Muslims from around the globe have to attend here and get together. There are some rituals which are usually done, one of which is saying Arafat dua, which was actually initiated by Imam Hussein, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him. The other importance of this, let's say, land, this holy land, is that Imam al-Zaman, Imam Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, is also here. The only problem is that the people here don't recognize who he is, though he is doing the rituals with the Islamic Ummah.
Staying in Arafat is one of the main parts of Hajj. The stay of pilgrims is said to lead to forgiveness of their sins. After staying in Arafat until nightfall, pilgrims will march or take a bus to the desert of Muzdalifah to collect pebbles to carry out the symbolic stoning of the devil later in Mina on Saturday. Mahdi Abbasian, Arafat Desert.
Cross-border humanitarian aid to Syria's Idlib is in a state of limbo after Russia and Western countries vote down each other's resolutions in a UN Security Council session. The Western text would have extended the aid by a year without asking Damascus. Moscow, however, proposed a six-month extension. It said the Western resolution ignored the sovereignty of Damascus. On the other hand, the U.S. accused Moscow of putting its own political interests above the humanitarian needs of the Syrian people. The current authorization for the aid deliveries expires Sunday. Shipments were being made from Turkey into the northwestern Syrian province of Idlib since 2014. The province is partially held by anti-Damascus groups. Russia says any assistance to them would require the authorization of Damascus. The United States will supply an extra $400 million worth of weapons to Ukraine amid the war in the country. Arms package includes four additional high-mobility artillery rocket systems known as HIMARS and more ammo. And Pentagon officials say systems help Ukrainian forces strike Russian targets more precisely and at longer targets. They say these systems also disrupt Russia's ability to conduct artillery operations. Western countries, the U.S. in particular, have announced billions of dollars of weapons shipments to Ukraine since the war began. Russia has repeatedly warned the West against providing Ukraine with weapons, saying arms deliveries amount to a proxy war by the U.S. and its allies against Moscow and prolong the crisis. As Russia continues to make gains in Donbas, Johnny Miller reports from the city most recently taken over by Russian forces.
The road to Lysychansk the most recent city taken by the Russians. It's strewn with the debris of war and feels like a post-apocalyptic wasteland. The small settlement of Toshkivka. There's so much destruction, it's uninhabitable. One of a few villages we pass that may, quite literally, be wiped off the map.
Now, we're on the road to Lyshansk at the moment, but we've hit a problem. We've come to this part of the road where there's a bridge. The bridge is destroyed. So it looks like we're going to have to find another way around a detour.
The Ukrainians have blown up many such bridges in order to slow the Russian advance. We reach Lysychansk. Remarkably, much of it remains intact, as the Ukrainians gave up this city without much of a fight, although the central administration district saw the worst of the fighting.
I went outside and saw a car driving with the letter Z on it, and there was a pro-Russian militia guy. He climbed up there, took off the Ukrainian flag, and hung the Russian flag, the flag of victory. And our joy began. People came to see the flag and they were happy. They were crying, laughing, and dancing. It was great, and I still feel this joy. I think it'll remain with me forever.
A statue commemorating the fallen Soviet soldiers during World War II. Ukrainians extinguished the eternal flame in an effort to expunge Russian culture from the city. It will be lit again soon. Now the city is under Russian control.
When it was Ukraine here, we lived, somehow. There were several incidents, like my wife owned a small hairdresser's. Once a man from some nationalist battalion came and made her speak Ukrainian. He was shouting and even kicked her. They took me away for questioning a few times. It was Ukrainization here. I'm Russian, and I was born here. They were trying to force us to assimilate.
They consider people here in Donbas subhuman. I always wondered whether we had horns or something. We were second-class citizens. One Ukrainian soldier who was born only 50 kilometers away from me asked me why I hadn't left to Russia. They told us all the time to leave. But why? I've lived here all my life. My parents died here. My daughter lives here. He told me I was pro-Russian and so I should leave. They treat us with hatred.
The Russian army has set up a museum on the street. Tanks and weapons taken from the retreating Ukrainian army. There are British N-Laws and American javelins, as well as an array of drones that have increasingly become an essential part of modern warfare.
We all have to work to restore our town. Those who can't work will work. Everybody. Old-age pensioners say they'll work anywhere if it's necessary. We will rebuild our town. It'll be great.
While this war is bringing devastation to the towns and cities in which the two armies meet, it also leaves behind a desire for peace and a determination for these people to rebuild their cities and their lives. Johnny Miller, Lysychansk.
Now, the suspected killer of former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has admitted using a handmade gun to assassinate him. Now, police say the 41-year-old suspect held a grudge against an organization that he believed Abe was a member of. The politician died in a hospital on Friday morning after he was shot at a political campaign event in the southern city of Nara. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said he is simply speechless at the news. Countries around the world have also expressed shock and concern. Iran has also condemned the assassination. President Ibrahim Raisi said that Abe was killed in an inhumane attack, Raisi called Abe an international figure who played an important role in developing historic ties between Tehran and Tokyo. Japanese political analyst Sajiro Takeshita says that gun violence is very rare in Japan, and that's why the attack on Abe is so shocking.
In Japan, we don't have gun crimes, period. I mean, last year, according to the police, there's been only one death by, you know, gun in Japan. A year before that, only four, and most of it is due to the mobs. So this isn't our, you know, daily incident that we face. And to have that to Mr. Abe, who has served this country the longest than anybody else, over 2,880 days, and to who also created a lot of positive legends, like, you know, Abenomics, for example. You know, to have him being shot in middle of the street while he's making a speech is, firstly, totally unacceptable, and also, secondly, very devastating. Again, this is Japan. It's not United States, where you, you know, often find people holding guns. Again, only one death last year on gun crimes in Japan. So I would have imagined that, you know, most of the SBs didn't think, you know, that anybody would have a gun shooting at him. Possibly, you know, knives or machetes, as you just pointed out earlier, but certainly not guns.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol will increase the country's energy production and seek sales of nuclear reactors abroad, reversing the previous administration's policy. The move has drawn opposition from environmentalists who are calling for increases in renewable energy and warn of risks in the face of the Fukushima nuclear disaster and South Korea's troubled aging reactors. Frank Smith reports out of Seoul.
Touting South Korea's nuclear technology to allies at a recent summit in Europe, President Yoon Suk-yeol will increase the country's nuclear energy production and boost reactor sales abroad. The previous administration began to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima nuclear disaster, problems with South Korea's aging reactors, and industry corruption. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's decision to reverse course and ramp up nuclear power comes as the country faces multiple challenges to meeting its energy requirements. South Korea imports almost 100% of its oil, leaving it open to costly crude price fluctuations. And rising temperatures have increased energy demand here to record levels. The government will resume suspended reactor construction, with nuclear generating 30% of the country's energy mix by 2030. The Yoon administration says the move will help the country reach carbon neutrality and create jobs. Environmentalists decry the policy turnabout.
Nuclear technology is inherently risky, and it's also expensive, and also it's not a good solution for climate change.
South Korea ranks last in the OECD in renewable energy production, such as solar, wind, and geothermal, which activists view as offering viable alternatives.
To replace fossil fuels without increasing nuclear and provide all the electricity needed with the renewables, that's a challenge. But based on the analysis from the governmental institutions, the renewable energy potential for South Korea is enough to provide all the electricity we need.
South Korea plans to export 10 nuclear reactors by 2030, currently vying for projects planned in Poland and the Czech Republic. Officials also this week announced funding for new small modular reactor, SMR, development. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In a lawsuit, Dominion Voting Systems accuses Fox Corporation and Rupert Murdoch specifically of allowing Fox News to amplify false claims that the voting company had rigged the U.S. election for Joe Biden. We have prepared for you an article written by Adam Gabbert. The piece is titled Fox and Friends Confront Billion-Dollar U.S. Lawsuits Over Election Fraud Claims. In the months following the 2020 U.S. presidential election, right-wing television news in America was a wild west, an apparently lawless free-for-all where conspiracy theories about voting machines, ballot-stuffed suitcases, and dead Venezuelan leaders were repeated to viewers around the clock. There seemed to be little consequence for peddling the most outrageous ideas on prime time. But now, unfortunately for Fox News Channel, One American News Network, and Newsmax, it turns out that this fact, New World, wasn't free from legal jurisdiction, with the three networks now facing billion-dollar lawsuits as a result of their accusations. In June, Dominion Voting Systems, which provided voting machines to 28 states, was given the go-ahead to sue Fox News Corporation, the parent company of Fox News, in a case that could draw Rupert Murdoch and his son, Lachlan Murdoch, into the spotlight. In the $1.6 billion lawsuit, Dominion Voting Systems accuses Fox Corporation and the Murdochs specifically of allowing Fox News to amplify false claims that the voting company had rigged the election for Joe Biden. Fox Corporation has attempted to have the lawsuit dismissed, but a Delaware judge said Dominion Voting Systems had shown adequate evidence for the lawsuit to proceed. Dominion is already suing Fox News as well as One American News Network and Newsmax. Judge Eric Davis said these allegations support a reasonable inference that Rupert Murdoch and Lachlan Murdoch either knew Dominion had not manipulated the election or at least recklessly disregarded the truth when they caused Fox News to propagate its claims about Dominion. Judge Eric Davis's ruling is not a guarantee that Fox Corp will be found liable, but the judge made it clear that this isn't some frivolous attempt by Dominion, and media and legal experts think Fox Corp could be in real trouble. Chiara Torres-Peliski, a professor who teaches constitutional law at Stetson University and a fellow of the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonpartisan law and policy institute, said, Dominion Voting Systems has a very strong case against Fox News and against One American News Network, for that matter. Chiara Torres-Peliski said the reason Dominion is suing is because Fox and other right-wing news outlets repeated vicious lies that Dominion voting machines stole the 2020 election from Donald Trump for Joe Biden. But all of these conspiracy theories about Dominion's voting machines were just pure nonsense. And Fox News, as a news organization, should have known that and not given this aspect of the big lie a megaphone. Torres-Peliski added, what's particularly bad for Fox News is that Dominion asked them to stop and correct the record in real time. And Fox News persisted in spreading misrepresentations about the voting machine company. Indeed, in his ruling, Judge Eric Davis noted that other newspapers under Rupert Murdoch's control, including the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post, condemned President Trump's claims and urged him to concede defeat. In a statement, a Fox News spokesperson claimed, limiting the ability of the press to report freely on the American election process stands in stark contrast to the liberties on which this nation was founded, and we are confident we will prevail in this case, as the First Amendment is the foundation of our democracy and freedom. Freedom of the press must be protected. A potential precedent in the Dominion voting systems versus Fox case could be found in a recent case involving Sarah Palin, who sued the New York Times. Sarah Palin claimed the newspaper maliciously damaged her reputation by erroneously linking her campaign rhetoric to a mass shooting incident. In February, a jury sided with the New York Times, finding that a New York Times employee had not acted with actual malice against a public figure or with reckless disregard for the truth, the criteria necessary to prove defamation. But Chiara Torres-Spelisky said the New York Times victory shouldn't give Fox too much hope, adding, in the Sarah Palin case, the New York Times quickly corrected the mistake about Palin that had been added while an article was edited. Torres-Spelisky noted, by contrast, Fox News Channel kept up the bad behavior and repeatedly told myths about Dominion's voting machines. This is likely why judges in several of these Dominion defamation cases have not dismissed them. Dominion Voting System isn't the only company seeking damages from Fox and its contemporaries. Smartmatic, an election software company which provided voting software to precisely one county in the 2020 election, but found itself subjected to claims that it was founded for the specific purpose of fixing elections by associates of Hugo Chavez, the former president of Venezuela who died in 2013, is suing Fox Corporation, Fox News, and associates for $2.7 billion. Still, some officials claiming Fox News is the most watched and arguably most influential cable news channel in the United States, and is probably too big to fail. But that isn't the case for the smaller right-wing networks, the One America News Network and Newsmax, which are also both being sued by Dominion Voting Systems and Smartmatic. In June, a Delaware judge refused Newsmax's motion to have the Dominion case dismissed, but did not weigh on whether Newsmax was innocent or guilty. Angelo Carusone, president and chief executive of Media Matters for America, which monitors right-wing media, said, "I think the One America News Network is going to be wiped out from the litigation costs. Forget about any judgment." Angelo Carusone pointed out that the One America News Network is already struggling to survive after it was dropped by the DirecTV cable company, which was reportedly responsible for 90% of One America News Network's revenues in April, adding, "Already we've started seeing them scaling back programming. They've been laying off staff, they've been cutting back on the number of programs. So it's pretty clear that they don't have sufficient resources to weather a protracted litigation process." Angelo Carusone, president and chief executive of Media Matters for America, said Newsmax, which is still carried by DirecTV, is relatively cash flush in comparison to the One America News Network, enough to survive a trial, if not to pay the billions of dollars Dominion and Smartmatic are seeking. In a statement, Newsmax said it had reported on allegations made by President Trump and his surrogates, "and at no time did we report these allegations were true. We also reported on critics of the Trump claims." It added, "The Dominion lawsuit is an assault on a free press and endangers all press outlets if it were to prevail." The One America News Network did not respond to a request for comment. Angela Carissoni, President and Chief Executive of Media Matters for America, added, "As for Fox News Channel, the most significant thing could be if the Murdochs are subjected to discovery, where they and Fox could be forced to hand over documents, potentially including communications data, as part of the legal process." Text messages obtained by the January 6th Commission have already revealed that there was communication between Fox News hosts and White House officials regarding the January 6th insurrection, and it seems unlikely that that is the only thing that was discussed. Angela Carissoni said, "I think once you start to pull the discovery material, what you're going to find is there was a lot of communication between the Trump people, both internally and externally, about pushing very specific lies and narratives. While Fox is more financially comfortable than the One America News Network and Newsmax, it is not invulnerable. Fox News Network is due to renegotiate its contracts with cable providers at the end of this year, and Angela Carissoni said cable companies could use the lawsuit to drive down prices. The Dominion voting systems and Smartmatic cases are likely to drag on for some time, and it remains to be seen how Fox News, the One America News Network and Newsmax will react.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, sisters and brothers. This is Asma, and I have the privilege to be your host for today's discussion. Well, here with me, I have two very dear and credible guests, Sister Zainab and Brother Muzaffar. It's been so long since the last time I met you two, and today I am over pleased to have you both in one picture. Okay, ladies, first I will start with you, Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, and
alaikum,
how are you doing?
Assalam. Thank you so much.
I'm glad.
I'm doing great, alhamdulillah.
Thank God.
Totally psyched to be here with you guys.
So pleasure to be with you. And you, brother, assalamu alaikum, and how's life?
Wa alaikum salam. Life is good, alhamdulillah. And I'm here after such a long time. And
yes,
great to be back.
Great to be with you.
Thanks
too.
Thanks for having me.
So, just as the ritual of this program, I would love you two to give me a very short introduction about yourself. And let's start with you, Brother Muzaffar.
Yeah, so I'm Muzaffar Haider. Mm-hmm. I'm born and raised in the UK. I'm studying in the Hausa, and now I occasionally show up at IRIB English Radio and discuss some interesting topics with you.
Of course. Topics.
Of course. And you, sister?
I'm Zainab. I'm a student of philosophy.
Philosophy is very interesting, though. So we're going to use your philosophy in today's table of discussion. And today we're talking about complaining and the people who complain a lot.
If we talk about people who complain a lot, does that count as complaining? Would we be complaining then?
Very quickly, we come back to philosophy. Well, complaining, I guess. Well, I would first give an introduction and mm-hmm. then I will have your opinions. Complaining by itself is not a bad thing. It's, I guess, a natural feature of a breathing being like human beings. It's not detrimental until it becomes a constant sort of a process that happens every single day and each day so repetitive in a way that becomes so annoying, just like nagging people. Do you think complaining is a natural feature and we shouldn't worry about it?
Complaining is a natural thing. Yeah, it is natural, but so many things which are natural are not necessarily good.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that complaining, especially complaining a lot, is not good for one's own personal health and for the health of those around them.
For sure.
Of course. Certainly don't like people who complain a lot.
You don't complain yourself?
I try to complain, but nobody wants to listen. And then I'm like, well, I've just listened. Like, I have a brother at work, for example, or somebody else who I'm working with, or and they just complain and complain. I'm listening. And then I'm like, I start to complain, and they're just like, oh, it just doesn't work.
And I
realize also that, look, if it was that much of a burden for me to hear that complaining, then maybe other people don't like hearing it either, so I shouldn't, and I should keep my troubles to myself.
Of course, that happens as we grow older. We'll learn to keep our problems for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's something very natural again.
Really? Yeah.
Yes.
Because I feel like the older people get, the more they complain. I think it's like...
well, we're talking about sensible people.
Well, that's a very small population of the world, isn't it?
Yeah. Of course it is.
That's a very small piece of the pie.
Exactly. I really feel that. And I think there's biological reasoning behind it too. It's ratio to age. Like the more you age, the more you complain. Because
The older you are, the naggier you get.
Yeah, because you're all worn out, aren't you?
Yeah, and I suppose you've seen so much that you have more to complain about.
Exactly.
And you're always going to be comparing the time in which you lived to the time in which you lived, the generation that you're experiencing now with the generation
and
that you
I think
belong to.
Children complain a lot too, and the thing that older people and children both have in common, which leads them both into being over complainers, is the fact that they are so helpless now. I'm not like saying 50 up. That's what I...
Well, we're youth, and we know that this number of nagging and complaining people are growing among the youth. So I don't guess it's just related to the older people.
The age, and it's not an age factor.
The very kids.
Actually, I think that's an interesting point, that you would see it in the younger people and then the older people as well. I guess we notice it more from the youngers than the olders.
Yeah.
And I do feel like it has something to do with their vulnerability.
Exactly.
They do feel vulnerable.
Yeah.
If we look at this from an akhlaqi perspective, Imam Khomeini in 40 Hadith, which is a beautiful book.
Ethical. Moral.
Moral, spirituality kind of thing. So it's akhlaq, right?
Mm-hmm. Not being a douchebag aspect of it.
Yeah, that thing.
Yeah.
So in the chapter about anger, it's really interesting where he talks about, and I'm a hypocrite for talking about this because I get angry all the time, but... anger, he says that there's a bad type of anger, right? And we're talking about the bad type of anger.
Of course.
He says that it usually belongs to the weaker people. You often get angry because you want to show that you are bigger and stronger than those around you.
Oh,
but
really?
Actually, it's rooting and stemming from your weakness. So it's more likely to exist in you when you're sick.
Yeah.
Right, when you are hungry, when you are poor.
And in misery.
And when you're miserable,
yes.
Because you don't have something. If you're strong, you're confident, you don't feel the need to express that anger. And I feel like complaining does come from a lot of the anger and frustration that we have pent up inside.
So we're getting to some very interesting points, but I would like you to hold it there and let's go for a little break. We'll be back in no time. Dear audience, stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So, welcome back to your audience. This is IRIB English Radio. We are having a discussion in your Back to Reality. And Brother Muzaffar was telling us that half of complaining comes from perhaps weakness.
Elderly people have lots of weaknesses. Younger people have lots of weaknesses. But the real problem is that complaining releases stress hormones. When you complain, you release stress hormones.
Yeah.
When you hear complaining, it also releases stress hormones.
So, and in an article I've been reading about this very thing that said complaining is as harmful as the secondhand smoke.
First of all, it's really important for us to draw a line between complaining and acknowledging a situation as problematic and pointing it out in order to...
It turns out to be complaining.
Reform
again.
The situation. There's a huge difference between these two. And often I found that complaining lacks action, and that's why it's so freaking annoying.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want to hear negative feedback and vibes about a certain situation constantly. And it because it makes you hopeless, because it makes you feel that, okay, then why should we even bother with this project, with this relationship, with this behavior, with this stage of our lives, if you're just going to nitpick the negative parts about this, if you're just going to highlight the bad parts, if you're just going to point out its downfalls and its shortcomings. So definitely that's something only weak people do.
Do you consider criticism as a sort of complaining?
If it's
so you say acknowledging a problem is different from complaining. So acknowledging is sort of criticizing a situation.
Yeah. As it's constructive criticism.
Actually, let me just give a quick example of complaining, because I think it would help the discussion a little bit. It's like complaining about the weather.
Yeah.
You can't actually
Nothing
control
Nothing can
it.
Be done. Exactly.
Nothing can change. Why are you complaining about it?
Bro, yeah.
It's raining. You get that all the time in the UK, right? It's raining again. Come on, it rains every day. Just chill out.
But you know, there's something good in complaining. And you know what's that?
What?
There is an emotional release.
Uh-huh.
You know, catharsis happens to
but
you.
But at what cost, really? You often end up being the annoying person in every gathering because you're always complaining. People will actively try to avoid you.
Exactly.
Sister, do you know what? I think Sister Asma has got better friends than us. They listen to her complain.
Oh, my God.
I hereby officially tell you that I'm not a complaining person. I usually practice patience. That's a better choice. I'm just siding with those who are complaining. I try to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because the majority of people nowadays, when you sit around them, when they find two ears, they start complaining, and I usually call it nagging.
Sometimes, it's cool. I mean, often people use it to form some sort of small talk. Often people use complaints to form some sort of small talk, don't they?
Yeah.
Which is another thing I try to avoid actively. Small talk. Why bother with small talk? But they're like, oh, have you seen the prices on that and that thing? Mm-hmm. Oh, did you listen to the whatever last night? You know,
So you mean they use complaining as a sort of breaking the ice?
Yes. And I mean...
No, but hold on. When somebody's doing that, they're not really complaining. They're just using the complaint as a tool.
Yeah, weapon.
Exactly.
That's not really complaining.
So it...
Complaining
it,
is bad.
It all comes down to the objective it serves.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a tiny, whiny little complaint that, you know, breaks the ice, makes the silent awkward go away, then by all means. It's not going to be constructive. It's just going to fill the air with negative vibes. It's going to emotionally and mentally drain the listener. And it's going to make you look like a total...
Annoying person.
A total annoying person. Mm-hmm. I recommend you avoid it because then you won't be invited anywhere.
Exactly.
And when you call, no one's going to pick up.
The annoying person is calling.
Why don't we do the opposite of complaining?
What then?
Point out the good stuff.
Yeah. Talk about positive things. So, for example, going back to
there's
the weather.
There's no emotional release in that.
Like, well, instead of saying, oh, it's raining, why don't you go, it's raining.
If you like rain, then it's good. But what about sun when it's too hot?
When it's too hot?
Yes. How would you make it beautiful?
It's hot and we're sitting in a room with AC. Yay.
Oh, my God.
You know, it's the opposite of complaining. Isn't that much better and more productive?
So you're pointing something very nice. You mean that we have to use some methods in order to control or complain and turn it into something beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
By using some beautiful expressions.
Why not
in order...
train children to think in a different way, you know? If they're going to be complaining about something, let them look at the bright side of it instead, as cliched as that sounds.
We come back to looking at the bright side of everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So being an optimist.
It's so important, though. I mean, life is going to suck either way. You're always going to find something to complain about,
yeah.
Right? If you're going to be so meticulous about life, why not pick out the good stuff?
Yeah.
Right? If you're
going
to go through the process...
But, you know, practicing that in real life is very difficult.
That's
so
true.
So saying that is very easy, but practicing that in a life full of problems is very difficult.
I think we're underestimating the blessings that we have. And that is actually one of the very...
pertinent.
Yes. And natural, innate... qualities of human being. They're kafur, you know, they're ungrateful.
Yeah, ungrateful.
And if you take one of the smallest blessings that we constantly have and constantly take for granted away,
yeah,
we would really then have a lot to complain about. Oh, the weather is so hot, but at least we still have running water.
We're breathing.
We still have electricity.
Yeah.
Right? Imagine if we were living in one of those countries that right now, they're going through the hottest heat wave of the past 30 years and they don't even have sufficient electricity in 24 hours.
So I guess we have made the story finished and we got to the point that we have to stop complaining and we have to look at the bright side of every single thing. So practice optimism. That's the cure for complaining.
Just last point.
Yeah.
If you can't find anything nice to say,
mm-hmm.
just stay quiet. You really don't have to comment about a situation.
Oh my God. Yes.
Right? Just stay quiet.
True.
It's fine.
Yeah. So stay silent.
Mm-hmm,
if you do not have anything nice to share, stay silent. So, dear listeners, this was all the time that we got for today's episode. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell, and may Allah protect you.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah.
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
IRIB English Radio Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The hypocrisy and double standards of the Western countries and their institutions have deeply disappointed us, although we had previously been aware of their positions, says Issam Khalidi Ryder in an article published under the heading Hypocrisy and Double Standards, the FIFA Message to Palestine, and the world. Stay tuned for more. The international sympathy with Ukraine illustrates the hypocrisy and double standards the West employs to handle this issue, as opposed to the silence and superior handling of other issues in Palestine, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya. FIFA and UEFA have prevented athletes and the public who support Palestine from mixing sports and politics, while sympathy for Ukraine has become part of the rituals of matches and ethics of these two organizations. The hypocrisy and double standards of the Western countries and their institutions have deeply disappointed us, although we had previously been aware of their positions. In response, many began reconsidering their dealings with these institutions, leading to a loss of respect for them. The Russian tennis player Artem Dzyuba said he opposes any war, but he asked, why did they separate politics from sports for so long? And then when it came to Russia, they forgot this principle. Morals are indivisible. That is, one cannot respect the feelings and rights of one group while ignoring and despising those of another group. As a result, many people, including former Egyptian football star Mohammed Abu Tryka, have called for sanctions against the fake regime of Israel, similar to those taken by FIFA and its European counterpart UEFA against Russia and its clubs. An announcer asked the Egyptian champion Ali Farag to talk about Ukraine when he won the Aptasiak squash championship in Britain. He replied, we all see what's going on in the world at the moment with Ukraine and with Russia. No one should accept any killing in the world or any oppression. We've never been allowed to speak about politics in sports, but all in sudden it's allowed. I hope people look at oppression everywhere in the world. Palestinians have been going through that for the past 74 years. The neutral stance of FIFA on settlement clubs participating in the Israeli League confirms the essence of its leadership, which is biased in favor of the Zionist regime and the Israeli lobby. In order to remain FIFA president, Gianni Infantino must abandon making principled decisions that might cause him headaches, upset his position, or threaten FIFA. FIFA must give in to influential powers such as the US and Israeli lobby, such concessions being its refusal to impose any sanctions against the Israeli Football Federation and its declaration that the territories are a concern for international authorities and FIFA must remain impartial. As a result, it is disregarding its own constitution and laws. It is ironic to see FIFA focusing on the state of the sports facilities Qatar is building for the World Cup 2022, and to see it criticizing the ban on travel by the US to many Muslim majority countries in 2017. Infantino criticized it, saying, when it comes to FIFA tournaments, any team that qualifies for the World Cup, including their fans and officials, must get a visa for the host country, or there will be no World Cup. Infantino also advocates against social ills and threats to the integrity of football in Europe, including racism, discrimination, violence, hooliganism, and match fixing. FIFA's position reminds us of Western regimes in general that call for justice and democracy but ignore it in their dealings with the fake regime of Israel. In 1930s, when there was a conflict in the Palestine sports arena between the Zionist-dominated Football Association, PFA, and Palestinian Sports Federation, which was founded in 1931 and re-established in 1944, FIFA did not hide its bias toward the first and its superior dealings with the second. In 1937, Khadar Kamal, president of the Arab Sports Club in Al-Quds, requested FIFA to allow Arab teams to compete with those from Egypt, Lebanon, and Syria at a time when Arab-Palestinian teams were not members of the PFA. Afterward, FIFA's secretary sent a letter to the PFA informing them about Kamal's request, mentioning that he had given no recommendation to these gentlemen in relation to Arabs and Khadar Kamal. From European and international organizations, it is not surprising to see such positions that sanctioned colonialism and helped pave the way for building the Jewish national home. Racist language and superior treatment of the backward East by the civilized West, as they claim, have always been present. Treating the East as an inferior species not worthy of respect but of contempt, and uncivilized people who are devoid of any potential for growth or progress. Throughout history, racism, hypocrisy, and injustice have been closely interconnected. FIFA, as well as other Western regimes, are suddenly sympathetic to Ukraine, as well as ignoring Palestine, probably because Ukrainians are civilized, have blue eyes, and live next door, as some Europeans have pointed out. Unfortunately.
Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.